Let us see this morning. Today is April 11, 2005, and I'd like to call the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development to order.
Representative Butler was kind enough to close the door for us.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, you are the first one that Representative Butler. Glad to have you with us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I'd like to open a public hearing, House Bill 3350, right?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Go on.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3350 expands the eligibility for counties to participate in business development tax incentive certificates for the preliminary certificates on or after July 1st, 2006. It authorizes participation for areas and counties among the highest one-third of the county unemployment rate or counties among the lowest third of county per capita income if they are zoned industrial or within an urban growth boundary of 15,000 or fewer residents. For preliminary certifications on or after July 1st, 2011, it changes limitation on participation from counties among the highest quartile to counties among the top half of county unemployment rates. It also changes the limitation on participation from counties with the lowest third to the bottom half of county per capita income, requiring that both criteria be met. You also... that's all the information I have on this one.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pretty. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. House District 60 is southeastern Oregon, representing 25% plus of the landmass of the state of Oregon. The House Bill 3350, which you have before you this morning, is a proposal that we expand the program called the Small Community Investment Program, the SCIP program. The SCIP program we came up with a number of years ago to attempt to bring new to Oregon business in to invest in property, plant, and equipment. The current statutory requirements include the fact that the folks that come in must do a number of things. They must have authorization from the city or county that they come in to, so as to not compete unfairly with anyone else that's coming in. They must move into a location where we have high unemployment together with low per capita income. So the combination, it's only as the two circles of high unemployment or low per capita income, it's only to the extent that those circles are concentric that we have the counties that qualify for this particular program. They must invest in property, plant, equipment with an estimated useful life of not less than 10 years so that we know that they're making an investment in our community. And then finally, the current requirement is that they must have five or more full-time employees. Now, members of the committee, lest you think that this is something that could draw folks to Tigard or to Beaverton or those kinds of things, new businesses into these areas, those are not the communities that we're actually shooting for. The Department of Economic Development has given us some information that the following counties would qualify for the proposed program right now. It would be Sherman, Gilliam, Wheeler, Mount Huer, Jefferson, Morrow, Baker, Lake, Crook, Harney, Umatilla, Josephine, Klamath, Coos, Union, Wasco, Lynn, and Hood River. These are the counties which have both the highest unemployment together with the lowest per capita wages. Now, the bill that you have before you is a proposal to expand the size of the pool to those counties. However, I have passed out -1 amendments, and there are -2 amendments of which I approve as well, but deal with a different portion of the community investment programs. The -1 amendment, after meeting with the Department of Economic Development, they said, you know, there is a problem with this bill. The reason why you haven't been able to attract anyone, why we can't attract folks to the state of Oregon, is that it requires that they pay 150% of the per capita wage of that those lowest counties. Well, that 50% of the lowest per capita wage can be as much as $36,000 a year. It's a minimum of around $27,000 a year, but can be as high as $36,000 a year. And they said, you're just not going to have anybody that's going to be new to Oregon that's going to be willing to start up with wages at $27,000 to $36,000 a year. So after consultation with the Department of Economic Development and some of my regional economic development coordinators in these distressed areas of Oregon, the Dash 1 amendment, which you have before you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, basically does the same kinds of things that the first bill does, and that is that the actual bill, 3350, does. But what it does is it then, down on lines 18, 19 of the amendment, basically removes the minimum annual compensation requirement being 150% of that wage. Now, lest you think that we're going to just try and seek businesses that are coming to town without paying anything, the minimum wage would be, if they just pay minimum wage, and this bill was all conceived back when Oregon's minimum wage was much less, the minimum wage that they would be paying is over $15,000 for a full, and that's assuming that they hire only minimum wage. My concern is that they probably will bring some professional wages, and then they will bring in other folks to do custodial and the secretarial and those kinds of things, all of which will bring us $15,000 a year jobs in those places where we have a lack of jobs because of the high unemployment this bill is targeted for. So if I could just call your attention to the bill itself, on page 1 of the House Bill 3350, which you have before you, on the face page, section 2 also sunsets this request, and this is sunsetted in the as to this request, and the section 3 requests are sunsetted in the proposed amended bill. That is, that this be a provision that would start beginning in 2006 and would go until January 1st, 2011, trying to bring our unemployment, Oregon's unemployment, down as a result of bringing new jobs to Oregon. And these are, in fact, new employment opportunities to Oregon as opposed to existing. And then, as I say, the Dash 1 amendments basically do away with all of Section 3, which is on page 2 of the original bill, and I would just call your attention to those Dash 1 amendments because then they re-amplify exactly what it is that is done in lines 1 through 13 on page 2, section 3, and that's replaced with the additional addendum and proviso down on lines 18 and 19 that the minimum wage portion of it go away, the compensation portion of the package. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I strongly urge you all to seriously give consideration to House Bill 3350 to attempt to see if we can't bring this disparity of the low wage. This is both Eastern and Western Oregon. You'll notice that there are some Central and Southern Oregon and those northernmost counties in Eastern Oregon, when you include Hood River and Wasco, but also Klamath and Josephine and Lake in Southern Oregon, and then, as I say, Coos and Coos is over, and I don't know if there's any other counties and coastal counties included, but I think that's the department will modify those counties that qualify on a year-to-year basis, and it gives them an opportunity to go out and target employment to come into Coos County or to Union County, these places where we have the high unemployment and the low wages.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you,
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Representative. Thank you for your testimony. Can you provide any information on the success of the SCIP program up to this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Buckley, we have Judge Mike MacArthur, former county judge from Cleveland County, Mike MacArthur, that's here today to tell you that there has been no success in bringing new jobs to Oregon. We've had revenue reports in the last two sessions saying we think this could cost us some money, And we've actually had revenue reports saying if somebody that was going to come to Coos County or to one of these qualifying counties would have come anyway, then it would have cost us some revenue if they'd have come to Oregon and made a profit. But I'm also here as an accountant to tell you that any business that moves to Oregon with our regulatory environment and rather expensive climate to get to work is going to probably not reflect the profit for the first few years that they're in Oregon anyway. That's been my experience as a businessman and as an accountant bringing businesses to Oregon, that typically their first few years are not, they really don't need the tax-free environment that we are providing, the income tax-free that we're providing on the business net profits. So it hasn't been as big of an attraction for businesses to come, but we believe that by sunsetting an opportunity to expand the number of counties that qualify and then expand the opportunity for those folks to come in at minimum wage or above for the types of opportunities that they'll bring, recognizing that the ultimate authority still rests with the city or the county. They have the ability to say, no, we don't want your new print shop in Monument. We feel like it'll compete with our other print shop over here in Fossil. So they still have that ability to say that they to pick and choose those that land employment in Oregon.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. I would like to ask
Representative Dallum.
Thank you very much, Chairman Lamb. I'd like to ask Representative Butler. The counties you listed, the ones that you represent, how long have they been listed in the top 10 for unemployment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, amongst the top 10, these folks in rural Oregon, and particularly eastern and southeastern Oregon, again this month, all have over 10% unemployment. I mean, this is chronic. I've had counties, and I'm almost ashamed to say this, Mr. Chair, I've had counties that have gone into the 30% percentiles of unemployment during the recession. And so I'm very, very anxious that these folks, which have a double crunch, not only do they have high unemployment, but they have low per capita wage, and they have typically all qualified. When the program, when the SCIP program was first set up, and remember, it has to be an investment in cities, ports, or within the city urban growth boundaries. This is not for something built outside of the city. We had support from much of the environmental community to encourage this kind of a thing early on, and they still are supporting, so far as I know. The concern that we had was that at first the program was so limited that only Lake County and a couple of other places qualified. When they tried to bring a business, and we did have a genuine business ready to go into Lake County, when we tried to bring that business into Lake County, we found out that their industrial park was not in the city limits. The vacant industrial park adjacent to city, I shouldn't say vacant, the buildings are there, and there is in fact one business in the industrial park that has been ongoing for many years, a lumber milling business. But we found out that all of those buildings did not qualify because the bill was so specific it had to be within the city limits. So we then expanded it to include within the city's growth boundary and within ports. Again, the issue was we wanted to try and bring those folks in to utilize all the city services so that they would be buying those city services and paying for those city services. And obviously it would be better if they were located right downtown taking up some of the vacant buildings in these areas, but virtually within southeastern Oregon, Mountaineer County did not qualify under the original programs. I think that Sherman, Wheeler, and Gilliam have always qualified under these programs. They have high unemployment and very low per capita wages. Harney County has been in and out. Baker County has been in and out. Mountaineer County has qualified a time or two. They from time to time will get their unemployment down to where it's only it gets to 7 or 8%. It's under 10 from a time to time. But, you know, that's still an awful lot of unemployment.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, on many occasions in front of us in this committee. In fact, the state economist told us that we must get manufacturing and technology going, and the rest of the state will follow. then the metaphor used was being stopped at a stoplight, that if we can get a few cars through on the green, our state will turn over. I feel that Representative Butler has brought us a bill that removes the counties with stubborn, immovable unemployment rates at least to the yellow light. And that will be a tremendous step forward for us. This is the first bill I've seen that actually puts some arrows in the quiver of those counties that I represent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Any other questions? Vice Chair Merkley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. There's a couple things that you described, Representative, that I just wanted to try to peg down here. You referred to this applying to new jobs, new businesses that are brought into the zone, and I just want to understand exactly how that works. I've been scanning the bill and the two amendments, and I'm having a little trouble getting my hands around that.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Merkley, thank you very much for that excellent question. The full section that this deals with, this full community, small community investment program, identifies that these businesses are new to Oregon businesses. They can't have picked up from one of the metropolitan areas and moved out to go out and see if they can't receive some income tax free benefit. So these are new opportunities within Oregon. They could be, in fact, they could be an existing entity within the state of Oregon, which is going to change its line of manufacturing or other service lines. And this was contemplated and is part of the testimony from the original bill, that if a company in Beaverton, which was very much dedicated to Oregon and wanting to grow Oregon and create a little bit of a healing moment for the rural-urban divide, was going to expand their services where they are producing chips and want to put those chips inside of a box, and that's not something that they're presently doing in Oregon. Maybe it's something they're doing in Washington or California, but that they wanted to bring that back to Oregon. If they would go to one of these small communities and start up that new business in that small community, then because it's a new line of business, and there are provisions within the bill that provide that entity would then go to the OECD and confirm with the OECD exactly what it was that they were going to do. OECD has the oversight and is able to charge for that service, incidentally. It's a very modest charge. OECD has assured me that if anybody came forward and wanted to bring 10 new jobs to any one of these communities that presently qualified, they likely wouldn't charge them the $500 that they have the ability to charge them, because we already have RDOs that are on the ground ready to try and bring these folks in. But they have the ability to charge, and there is an annual opportunity to charge also for recertification of an existing business. But the original charge that can be levied is to determine that they meet all of the qualifications, in fact, that they are either moving a business from out of state into Oregon, or that they are starting up a new-to-Oregon business in a community that doesn't compete anywhere else in that community unfairly.
Thank you, Representative Butler. In your last sentence, you mentioned the doesn't compete with any other business, and I wanted to understand that piece. Let's say you mentioned a printing business. If I have a printing business in a small town, then would someone who is applying to come to my small town with a similar printing business not qualify for this?
Chairman, Vice Chair Merkley, that's an excellent question, because it is given to the local city and or the local county to go ahead and say, either of those two, the county commission or the city council, can say, we think that this particular line with of printing, and again, remember, we're talking about cities under 15,000, and so if there's already a printing plant there, I think in my district I only have two cities that have printing presses in them. Yeah. But if somebody else came to town, and I've got three. I beg your pardon. I do have a third. I probably have a fourth. I want to think about this. But if somebody else came to town and said, we want to go ahead and set up a new printing operation that would compete with the Mount Hill Enterprise in Vail, then the Vail City Council could say, wait a minute, we have a homegrown business with two employees here. why would we give that up for someone who is new to town coming in if it would unfairly compete? Because remember, the one business presently pays income tax if they're making a profit,
right.
Whereas this other business, if they are truly going to make a profit, would not. And it gives them then the opportunity to come in. They have to make an investment in Vail of property, plant, and equipment, and hire five or more employees. Chances are that if it's not something really truly new to the community, then it would probably not be landing in the community. The your issue with the non-compete came into consideration here relative to the fact that I do have a small business, a very unique small business in Miss Oregon that does some specialized dye presses, and this is an Oregon family that said we want to move back to Oregon. They brought these $1 million presses back to Oregon, set them up in Oregon to make this special dyes, and brought up a pretty good staff with them when they and then hire some local people. If someone else wanted to come to NISA and say, look, here's a dye printing press, a dye shop right down the street here that's doing a pretty good business, why don't we set up in competition? Or if they wanted to go to Vail and set up that same kind of a business, the county court, or the county commission in this case, or the city of NISA, or even the city of Vail could come in and say, wait a minute, two of the three employees are presently commuting from Vail. We don't think we want that to go away. So we have the cities with oversight and ability to say we think it would compete unfairly, as well as the department. They cannot accept the application, but it gives that element of local control so that the department isn't trying to force a new business into the community that really the community leaders don't want either.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the statutes that govern this are ORS 285C500 through 285C506, and I've tried to include copies of that in your handout on this bill. The bill itself affects only a small number of these statutes, so for the other information on the procedures for obtaining the tax benefits and the specific language on the tax benefits, you can see those statutes that you have copies of.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nesson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good Representative Butler. Thank you for bringing us this bill, and thank you for caring about the people in the state. Sales is what is the engine for this economy, and without business, we're for naught in this state. I noticed in the amendment, in one of them, it talks about this rural, rural renewable energy development zone. It said in order to have one of those, you have to be an enterprise zone. I'm sorry that I missed the first identification of the counties you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, perhaps Mike Nelson, Mike.
MacArthur. Yeah. can you hold on 1 second? And I have some timeline that after Representative Butler testify ended, I'd like to move on because that the other members has to go on time. So if I could get you a little later, I'd appreciate it. You will get the answer for that later, okay?
No.
Mr. Chair,
can
Representative Nelson, that deals with -2 amendment and Association of Oregon Counties.
Yes, I understand.
Thank you.
May I ask one question?
Yeah, please hold at this time. And any questions to the Representative Butler at this time?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Butler?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Butler, my question was, I didn't get to finish it, was is there a reason that we can't identify this as cities versus counties? I mean, because, for example, in Yan Hill County, I have cities that are destitute, but as an entire county, we're, fourth lowest per capita. But so could it be individual cities? Would you consider that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, that's an excellent point. There are a lot of cities and counties that are doing fine. There are a lot of cities who suffer from these kinds of distress. The unemployment numbers are not reported by city. They're reported by counties. And the the per capita earnings is an annual amount given to us only by county. So it would be very difficult to try and break this down to a city by city. As a matter of fact, it would be impossible under our current reporting method. So what we've attempted to do is to try and bring some jobs back into some counties in an attempt to see if we can't jumpstart this stubborn unemployment problem we have in these counties.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you. If you have any questions, please hold. We will be back, and after we'll be back today again. And with that, I'd like to close up public hearing in 3350.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you for your time. And I'd like to open the work session, House Bill 3061. And I'd like to...
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3061 is the bill that allows the governor to appoint international goodwill trade ambassadors.
I don't know why.
You previously heard this measure on the 4th of April.
What was that one? Before what? April what?
April 4th. You heard it a week ago.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. Thank you. And I'd like to call the Director of International, the OECDD, Mari Brantley, good friend of ours, and appreciate your coming. I understand you have a meeting at the 10 o'clock in Portland, and so thank you for your the time and waiting. And would you like to make any comment on this House Bill 3061?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for having us here today. Before you is a conversation with House Bill 3061, which talks about the ability of the governor to appoint some international trade ambassadors. We are supportive of this House Bill, Mr. Chairman. We think that this is a part of an overall effort that we are trying to get going, and I'm comfortable of where we are making progress on revamping our whole international approach, if you will. There have been a series of meetings with some very good private sector as well as some public sector people as to what we should do with our international trade. We are almost there to put out a draft message for you all to kind of consider and to weigh in with. We're not quite there yet, but we'll meet tomorrow morning. House Bill 3061 would fit very much into that overall more aggressive stance that I think that we as a department feel that we need in order to represent Oregon better on the international climate. The only caveat that I would have, Mr. Chairman, would be that we combine our knowledge base with the people who might be appointed, because we have done some of this in the past, and I would say that probably it has been a little mixed. Some representatives, for example, some ambassadors, perhaps are not as familiar with Oregon as they should be, and I think that combined with the governor's knowledge, our knowledge, private sector, and you all, that we can get some really good people, and that would again push our agenda a little bit more aggressively. So we are in favor of House Bill 3061.
Thank you. And well, it's really on us to move out. Do we have a motion to?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3061 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Merkley moves House Bill 3061 to the floor with the two pass recommendations. Any discussions? If not, call the roll, please.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Down.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Chair Lynch.
Aye. The House Bill 3061, and what do I say? Motion passes. Okay, that's what I said. Okay.
And you want to appoint a carrier?
Any volunteers to carry this bill to the floor? Okay. Representative Dunham will carry House 3061. like to close the work session on House Bill 3061. I'd like to open House Bill HJR 29, work session.
Mr. Chair, House Joint Resolution 29 encourages the sending of a legislative international trade mission to China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. You also heard this a week ago on the 4th of April.
Okay, before we have a formal work session, and the Mari, would you like to make a comment on this 29?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. HJR 29 also goes along well with, I think, what we are planning again in a much more visible and aggressive stage for our international. I think that we need a presence in many of these countries that we hope to do business in. And in my opinion, we have the ability to do that. We have some great knowledge in the private sector as well as the public sector. And I'm understanding that HJR 29 would include both the private sector as well as the public sector to make such a trip. And that visibility, I think, would be very good. If we can encourage the governor to go along, too, we will certainly try to do that.
That would be great. Any questions? If not, yes. Representative Dallum.
I want to be sure that the governor was reminded of agriculture, both food and fiber. Those are huge industries when you get on the other side of the hill, and I want to be sure they were represented.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallum, I think that in the planning for this one is very important. In the past, sometimes we've done some trade missions that haven't honored the traditions of some of the countries as well as we probably should. So this will go forward, I think, in terms of putting this hopefully on the agenda, and we can do the pre-planning with agriculture, with energy, with the port, with a number of other people. I think maybe one of our challenges is to not get this mission too big, to have it very specific in terms of where we want to go and what we want to accomplish. But I appreciate those comments. Thank you.
I just want to make the same comment that this bill is, resolution is inclusive, including all business people in our state and government, and that everyone, if possible. So we do not. This is not any exclusive to someone else. This is all inclusive. Okay. And with that, and I'd like to, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we send HJR 29 to the House floor with a do adopt recommendation.
And Vice Chair Bruin, that the move to adopt HJR 29 and to the floor with the two pass recommendations. Any discussions? If not, those who are in favor of this SJR 29 say aye. The
aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Call
the roll.
Okay.
I have not finished yet, okay. Those who oppose say nay, and please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Dowd.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Lynn.
Aye. And this motion passed. And can I ask the Vice Chair Merkley to carry this bill? I do appreciate it. And we'll close our work session this year 29. And then I'd like to. Do we have a people from counties? And
yes.
Thank you very much for your coming, and appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And thank you. And I just want to recognize that my good friend Junichi from the International Trade Division here, and I just want to thank you for coming, and appreciate for your work in the past, and appreciate for your leadership. He has been working on the Korea and also Japan and trade issues. Thank you.
That was nice.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, and what's the next?
Back to 3350.
Okay. Yes, is that the people and from county here?
Doris Penwell.
Doris Penwell here? Where's Mike?
Mike is not here.
He was
Brad,
here.
Brad.
Okay. Okay. Is Mike coming back?
He left because he thought he wasn't going to hear that.
No, I said I was going to open it again. That's the bill? Okay.
That's it.
That's a good suggestion. I'd like to open a public hearing, House Bill 2179.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2179 amends the State Building Code to allow the Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services to establish alternative regulatory options for the purpose of encouraging emerging technologies. You have consensus amendments. These are the dash ones from the Building Codes Division. It limits the adoption of rules for establishing alternate regulatory options for emerging technologies by requiring consultation with the chairperson of the advisory board. It also requires consideration of national and international standards, and it requires application be limited to a specific site. It also requires that the scope of practice of any license not be adversely affected, any licensee. I think you have copies of the dash one.
Yes, I do. Everyone has the copy?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a few extra copies that I'll put out in case anyone.
Okay. I'd like to call at this time Patrick Allen and is it Jim Crown? Or how should I pronounce that?
Craven.
Yes. Yes, Jim. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. House Bill 2179 comes to you as part of the state agency's regulatory streamlining overall initiative. This continues work from last session dealing with the state's ability to provide rapid approval of emerging products and technologies. We believe that what this does is allow new products and technologies to be put into use in a way that's predictable and that is responsive to changes in technology in the state, and allows us to focus on specific risks that those may entail. An example that I would use, which you dealt with individually legislatively last session, has to do with electrical manufacturing equipment in the high tech industry. Existing system of licensing that equipment at the time basically required that you take something that was a multi-million-dollar piece of manufacturing equipment at a company like Intel and have it tested like a toaster is, underwriter's laboratory kind of a standard. It was an expense and a time process issue that didn't provide any safety benefit. This bill would allow us, as amended by the Dash 2 amendments, Dash 1 amendments, to deal with those kinds of issues in a site-specific way, to allow us to handle those kinds of technologies in ways that can benefit the state's economy if they're developed, used, or manufactured in the state.
All right. Any questions? If not, Jim?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven with the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. I'm just here to give a little bit of an attaboy to this bill. We did make, as Mr. Allen suggested, some good progress last session on a specific issue involving electrical equipment, but that took several years to sort of bring everybody together, and it took a legislative enactment. What we would like to see is this flexibility within the Building Codes Division. We think they have come along long way in the last couple of years to really be attentive to the needs of industry and such, and this is, as Mr. Allen said, in a package of bills of what we're calling regulatory streamlining this session. I think there were some concerns by various parties that I believe are addressed in the Dash 1 amendments that this is site-specific unless it's run through one of the advisory boards, so there's checks and balances. I wasn't party to all those discussions, but I understand and people who had some concerns have brought those forward in the Dash 1 amendments. So I encourage you to move forward with this bill. Thank you very much.
Okay, any questions? Representative Merkley.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Craven, Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen, Could you tell us who all participated in those in the work group, and whether they're present today or otherwise support the Dash One Amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I can't give you chapter and verse who participated. I'm actually covering this bill for Mark Long with the Building Codes Division. My understanding is that building trade organizations as well as contracting organizations participated, and that those concerns have been addressed. But I'm afraid I can't tell you exactly who participated.
All right. Any other questions? This Dash 2 amendment, that the all Section 2 has been replaced with Dash 2 amendment.
That's the Dash 1
amendment. Dash 1 amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Correct. Thank you. All right. Is any other person like to testify on this House Bill 2179? Thank you very much.
Representative Nelson.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jim and Pat. Could you give me, Mr. Chair, could you give me examples of what kind of technology? I mean, I'm really dumb in that area that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I can attempt. Of course, you know, by the very nature of technology being emerging, it would in some instances be able to defy being able to tell you today what that might be in the future. But I'd go back to the example and talk a little bit more, and maybe Jim can as well, about electrical manufacturing equipment in the high-tech industry. Each new generation of chip that gets manufactured at a company like Intel requires its own evolved set of manufacturing equipment, the things that they use to manufacture that chip. If you try prospectively in code to define everything about that equipment, you're either going to have a definition that doesn't make any sense, or one that will become obsolete as the industry evolves. And so the idea here is, as that manufacturing process evolves or new technologies become available, you're able on a site-specific basis to be able to approve them so that you can prove them out, get experience with them, and then through the regular code process make that equipment something that's widely available around the state.
Please, Mr. Chair. Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair and Pat and Jim, I'm concerned about this bill because I do not understand why we're telling Intel how to develop their technology. Or we had OHSU here recently, and we're losing a lot of business that OHSU would be generating in, for example, all their scientific discoveries and the technology that they use medically. And so I am very doubtful that the state needs to be in that business.
Mr. Chair,
I'm curious why we are.
Mark Long has just come into the room, and perhaps he can join us here. I'll take a stab at answering your question. The issue is any kind of electrical equipment is subject to the state building code, to the state electrical code. And so if it's an installed piece of machinery that is wired, it's covered under the building code. What this does is allow us to have some flexibility at the margins in that building code to recognize new technologies as they develop and help the code evolve in a way that's flexible and recognizes the design cycles that those industries are in. But these pieces of equipment would continue to be, since they're something that's in place in a business and wired, that would continue to be subject to the building code. And I don't know if the chair might want to call Mark Long to come up and expand on that at all.
Okay, Mark. Mark Long, could you expand?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long on the Administrator Building Codes. I apologize. I've tried to be in three places this morning yet before whatever time it is. I probably wasn't in the room when the first question came up, so if you could help me, I'd be happy to kind of walk you through what we're trying to do with this bill and then any questions that you have. And
thank
I don't
you.
Want to repeat any of the
May
previous
I, Mr.
testimony.
Chair?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Long, for hustling in here. Appreciate it. I'm just concerned. I don't look favorably upon this bill because I think that this is the best way to discourage emerging technologies is for the state to, you know, put more regulatory inspections and all this stuff, when the truth is you nor I know what's essential for Intel to prosper and produce, or OHSU, as I used previously in an example. I don't think you nor I would, you may be a genius, but I'm not. But, you know, it just seems like this is one more encumbrance, you know, to business, and we don't need it. How would we even justify it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think at a particular point I agree with you, but the purpose of this bill is to remove the quirky nature of the codes. What I'm passing out is just a little bit about our organization. And on the last page, and I don't know how much Pat talked about this, we've really been working on trying to streamline the process for building codes and make sure that in Oregon we really have an expedited or fast way to attract businesses. And one of the things that I'm providing you, and you're more than happy to read the rest of the things that I'm working on, is this essential construction projects. This bill and this background piece of paper was passed last session under Senate Bill 715, some of the streamlining things that we did. And what under Senate Bill 715 allowed us to guarantee to prospective businesses that meet the criteria that we will get through the building codes process, the process of approving the building, permitting and inspecting, then come to the state. And we have all kinds of resources to speed that up. And it's been very helpful in attracting businesses. What this bill does before you with this session is take the next step for products. As a regulator, one of the biggest things I'm concerned about as we start working with emerging technology and new things that, frankly, Representative, I don't understand either, that we're going to have some kind of regulation that would prohibit or keep that business from either manufacturing or developing or producing. So what this bill does is it goes on with the -1 amendments. You can see it says, notwithstanding my current law, I can go in a very fast manner and approve these products in as little as 60 days as opposed to several years that occurred before. So I think we agree on a particular point, and I need this piece of legislation in order for me to speed the process up and align Oregon with the things that we're doing for land to attract businesses, the things that I'm doing with the bill that was last session to make sure the building process goes smoothly, and then if there is some kind of new technology that our regulations would create a problem in, allows me to approve that much faster than the current system. Now, we could argue whether or not we should have a role in approving the products. That's a different question that I've been unable to solve at my end. But I need this to make the system work better. I hope I answered your question.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Long. I'm still, you know, but not persuaded to support this. What Representative Merkley previously asked, who was involved in drawing this up? And I guess we could start with that. Maybe that'd help me understand if I knew who likes this stuff.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, at Building Codes, we work with a group that's called the Construction Industry Policy Advisory Committee. And unfortunately, I don't have a handout of who participates, so I'll have to go off the top of my head. It's 18 different local government and industry stakeholder groups that work with building codes in this state. So this particular language was worked out with representatives of the building trades, representatives of the electrical and plumbing contractors, local government.
Who would that, excuse me, Mr. Chair, who is local government?
Mr. Nelson, the Oregon Building Officials Association and the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. Those are the groups that I work with.
And a follow-up, please. I guess what I'm trying to understand is that it seems to me that the citizen or private workers should be the ones involved in working through this, because I can't imagine, you know, these individuals, even League of Counties or League of Cities, knowing what kind of technology Intel needs. So I guess I'm
Mr. Representative Nelson, the reason why they're at the table...
A lot.
And I apologize. The reason why they're at the table, just a real quick thing about building codes. At the state of Oregon, that's where I'm from, we set the standards for construction, whether it be how you license an electrician or a plumber, to the codes, which includes product standards of how every building in this state is built. Most folks don't know that about us. Oregon is extremely unique in that we're one of the only states, and you can probably think about it, we're one of the only areas of regulation where the state adopts a standard, and then that standard is carried out in 130 different localities around the state in the same manner, or at least it's supposed to be. So the reason why those folks are at the table is because we set the standards, and then those cities and counties carry out the standards on our behalf. They're kind of the boots on the field, so to speak, so we have them participating in this. But again, I want to be clear on what we're trying to accomplish here. Many of my regulations already cover how the building's built, and many times how the product, the actual manufacturing piece of equipment that goes into the building, how it's regulated and how it isn't regulated. And the problem that I have, and that's why this is kind of weird to get your arms around, because this is proactive solutions to what I anticipate is going to come up. When we work with, and I don't want to be repetitive of any previous testimony, but when we work with Intel and some of the other companies, when they're bringing in these very sophisticated pieces of equipment, our regulations actually suggested that we were supposed to regulate those the same as a toaster, and you may have heard that already. And it took us several years to work through all the issues with the local folks and the trades and the contractors and the industries to make sure that we really weren't, when we exempted them, which is what we did, that we weren't creating a problem. What this allows me to do is be very proactive and say, notwithstanding some of my regulations that I have already, I can go into this expedited approval process when somebody comes along like biodiesel is kind of a common thing people are talking about right now. My concern is let's say Oregon makes a commitment and we work towards promoting that technology, and some smart person other than us regulators comes up and says, I've got this masher that does X, Y, or Z. Or our regulations going to suggest that that masher is a water heater or something silly like that because they're outdated? This allows me to approve those in as little as 60 days as opposed to as many as 6 years, which I think lends no predictability, lends a lot of uncertainty. So that's really what I'm trying to accomplish here, and hopefully I've made it clear, and I'll be happy to follow up on any other questions.
If you just let me, I'd ask one more question.
One more question.
Thank you. Ms. Long, let me explain to you. For example, in my county, I have a little town called Lafayette.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably enough jobs there for maybe 40 people. So a man came in to put in a gas station and a store that you go in and buy bread, quick stuff.
Right.
I mean, hurting desperately, the state held them up for over 2 years. And I'm just asking, you know, why are we doing that already? And it's not just for emerging technology, you see. Why aren't we expediting this entire process? And another example, if I could, is I'll give you an example of a electronic shop in my major city in my district where they're ordered to hire only union personnel from Portland to work, for example, at A&E Safe and Lock Company, and to pay them $27 an hour plus $6 an hour for benefits if they have an opening. And these individuals, number one, don't want to live in my county. They immediately, when there's an opening in Portland, they head back, but yet your organization has prescribed this. So I'm just saying, it does appear to me that the state knows what's best for emerging businesses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you may be correct there. I can only suggest to you that in the couple years I've been at the helm, we're chipping these things off one issue at a time. And this is the issue that I believe is very important, not only to our organization, but to the state of Oregon as a whole, to make sure that if we make a public investment in emerging technology or high tech or whatever it is, that we don't do some of these things that you just talked about. As far as the gas station goes, Lafayette is actually a third-party contracted organization through the city. I'm not sure, but I'd be happy to look into it. What we're trying to do with what I talked about here, although it doesn't help with the gas station, I'd be happy to work with you to expand it to other kinds of products, because there's no reason why it should take 2 years or any other length of time to do that. This bill is about trying to solve those kinds of problems. Unfortunately, when I came in 2 years ago, I thought I could get this all turned around in 6 months, and I'm finding out that it takes a little bit longer than that. But each session, you'll see our organization come in with things to try to make the system better, and I think this is going to help.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, if I can just add, I think we're talking about the same thing, but we're kind of missing each other in the process. We think that this bill is designed to address, in fact, the issue that we don't know. We as regulators won't necessarily know what in fact are the most promising technologies, the most promising products that the private sector will come up with. And this bill gives us flexibility to act on those circumstances when they arise, given that we don't know ahead of time what those kinds of things are going to be. I think we're trying to solve the exact problem that you're talking about.
One last thing, follow up, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson. Off the point of this bill, if you're having a problem in your district with a gas station or anything taking several years for the building code thing, I want to know about it, and I'll give you my card. Because just like when it's a larger installation, we get out there and we make sure that the locals know that the state's interested in making these things happen. I'll just tell you a story. In Milton Freewater, a small company, Noble Panels, was wanting to expand their business. They were talking about going to Washington because of the same kinds of concerns. We made a commitment that we would meet them in their building and work with their designer and get their plans approved in a two-week period and get it done. And I'll be damned if that didn't change all the dynamics, and they're off and running and pouring concrete today. So.
Okay.
Irrespective of this bill and any other issue, I want this committee and anybody else to know that we're very, very serious about making sure that we provide. My three goals are customer service, consistency, and then making sure that we enforce the regulations equally throughout the state. And it's a bigger job than what I thought, but we're continuing to work on it.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, thank you very much. It's great to hear the kind of approach you're taking to this. Do you foresee a time then coming back to us and saying you'd like to expand the same sort of approach instead of just to emerging industries but to Oregon industries across the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckley, I would like to do that. As you know, many of these issues require a lot of stakeholder involvement, and I don't necessarily hold all the cards when I'm dealing with this, but from an agency standpoint, the answer is yes. What I can work out through the rest of the process, all I can say is I'll try.
All right.
Okay. Excellent.
All right. Representative Dellum.
Yes, just for the record, I do want to make a point. You had a meeting with 18 stakeholders, each one of them a government agency?
No, sir.
How many of them are government agencies? Half?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dellum, actually, three organizations out of the 18 were government. The rest are private.
And the others were unions, craft unions, I would suppose, and contractors and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, they're the Building Contractors Associations, both large and small, the plumbers, the electricians. I'm going off the top of my head.
Very good. Yeah.
But it's a broad spectrum of both. We call them signatory, or you might call them union signatory types of interests, as well as non-signatory types of interests.
Anyway, we're trying to speed up the regulations for business. What we want to do and what we want to give you the authority to do in your turn, so that I can expedite my regulations. I think where Donna is, pardon me, Representative Nelson, where Representative Nelson is going is, I am 100% in support of this bill. But I'm very concerned that it doesn't go far enough. If we have 18 stakeholders involved, and we're trying to build something like Intel, and we have to come to the state and bring 18 agencies to the table before we even move, I'm reminded of the statement, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I'm doubting very much whether we've offered anything constructive at all, and I certainly will support this bill, but I want it to go a lot further.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowling.
I think we're in the same place.
Yeah, when I started this job, I was 25 years old, and I had a lot of hair. I'm not sure I disagree with you.
Thank you for
indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify, when you refer to the plumbers and electrical contractors, are you also including the plumbing and electrical workers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, yes. The IBW, Local 290 is part of the process. We work with, again, in my world, you don't do anything without communicating to all the interests, which includes labor as well as contractors and general contractors, developers, local government, the whole spectrum of folks.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? I think this is a good deal, and this is the one step, and I'd like to agree with the Representative Dallon. We'd like to go even further, but let's do that one step at a time, and we might be able to accomplish in the future more. And thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any other person like to testify on this House Bill 2179? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2179. Let's open a work session, House Bill 2179. We have a dash one amendment with us. Mr. Chair? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 2179.
Vice Chair Bruin and moved the House Bill that the adopt dash one to the House Bill 2179. Any objection? It's adopted. And
Mr. Chair,
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we forward this bill to the full House with a due pass recommendation.
With a dash one amendment.
With the dash one amendment. Yes.
And Representative Riley moves the House Bill 2179. And with the dash one amendment with a two pass recommendation to the floor. Any discussion? If not, those who are in favor of this bill, say aye. And opposed, say nay.
Are we adopting the amendment? Is that what we're doing?
No. It's already adopted, and we are moving the whole bill.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Anyway, please call the roll.
Representative Down.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. And this motion passed. And I'd like to give this Vice Chair Bruin to carry on the floor.
Mr. Chair, first of all, thank you very much for that, and I'd be honored to do that. Actually, Representative Riley, because he has such a large high-tech industry in his district, would ask to do that. If you don't mind, if I transfer that to him.
I think that's a real suggestion. I do appreciate that. And if the Representative Riley willing to carry this bill, I do appreciate it. Thank you. I think it's the right place and the right person to carry this bill. With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2179. And then we will move on again, opening a public hearing on, what was that one? 3350. Public hearing.
We wanted to hear from the counties. Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, let me organize myself first. Who am I calling?
I call Mr. Hibby or Doris
Penwell. Okay, I'd like to call at this time Doris Penwell and Brad Hickey. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the
committee.
Good morning. I'm Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm sorry Mr. MacArthur had to leave, but he has a whole bunch of county commissioners over at another meeting. He has
sorry,
to run the meeting, so that's all right.
Yeah, would you please give my good regards that I was not able to accommodate at this time, but maybe he misunderstood what I was going to do.
Mr. Chair, I think he did, but that's just fine. We can move ahead anyway. And I'm here in support of Representative Butler's bill, House Bill 3350, and in particular, we want to speak to the Dash 2 amendments, which were an addition to his bill that amended the Small Businesses Tax Incentive Program in rural areas of the state. The reason we brought the Dash 2 amendments is that the Rural Renewable Energy Program, which was established last legislative session, we thought would be a very effective tool for small-scale energy projects to be established in certain areas of the state that were particularly suited to those areas. When the bill passed, we expected to be able to allow local jurisdictions to negotiate with some of these businesses up to $100 million in tax incentive in order to establish their energy project. When we started, and Mr. MacArthur was in Sherman County at the time, he was chief judge, he was trying to negotiate with the business to do this, he found that the interpretation by the state, not the department, but I don't believe that the Attorney General said that you had to allow a $100 million tax exemption. And he was trying to sort of contain things by negotiating with the business up to $100 million rather than giving away the whole thing. So we decided we'd better come in and ask for a change to the statute to be more specific about what was allowed by the local jurisdiction. So that's what is before you in the Dash 2 amendments. And I think Brad Higbee with Renewable Energy could speak to the issue as well and give you some more specifics about what's going on in the state of Oregon now.
Okay, Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Brad Higbee, appearing on behalf of the Renewable Northwest Project. It's a nonprofit entity that's made up of both consumer and environmental organizations as well as renewable energy developers serving the Northwest. Interested primarily in promoting the development of renewable energy in the Northwest as well. I was happy to work with a number of counties last session in creating the Rural Renewable Development Energy. That's harder for me to say than you actually imagine. I almost chipped a tooth last session trying to come up with the title that LC concocted for this program. But the red zone, which is easier to say, I found. It's very simple. There were a number of counties in central and northeastern Oregon who were good renewable energy resource areas, trying to, interested in luring some rural developments, particularly wind projects. To make the projects work, they were looking to come up with a package of incentives to lure the developments to their counties. There was a developer that was trying to concoct their own incentive that many of the counties did not like. So we sat down, we talked with Laura Pryor, Gilman County Judge, Mike MacArthur, then Sherman County Judge, and the folks from Wheeler County as well, to come up with this alternative. And it's very similar to a basic enterprise zone, but one of the reasons we went with something like this is because it provides a little more flexibility. As you know, I believe the state is still limited to 18 enterprise zones, so if you've got 18 going right now, you can't create any more to lure a new project. Also, they're somewhat limited geographically and by how far you could stretch them to make them reach out to some of the remote windy areas where a wind project might work. The red zone essentially creates a renewable energy zone in the entire geography of a county so that you don't have to worry about arbitrary barriers and limitations and boundaries. But one of the best things about it is that it's up to the county whether or not they wish to do this on a project-by-project basis. They don't have to. If they create a zone, pretty much any business could locate in that zone without any further intercession by the county board. But this way, the board has a chance to work directly with each of the developers that come into their county as to whether or not this program is to be used. As Doris said, we had hoped that it would be fairly clear in the bill that if a county wished to seek authorization for a red zone and make application to the department, they would have authorization for up to a total of $100 million of property tax abatement authority. Again, it's too bad Mr. MacArthur isn't here because as Judge MacArthur, he was intimately involved with trying to use this program after last session. And I believe there was a wind project in the neighborhood of $60 million if Judge MacArthur had applied for authorization, he was worried that he was told he could only get $100 million worth of authority, nothing less than that. And he was worried that if he used the $60 million for this one project, there would be a $40 million float that somebody else could swoop in and take advantage of without he, on behalf of the county and the county board, having sufficient opportunity to negotiate. Now, why would a county want to do this? Very briefly, Mr. Chair. It's not just because of their widespread interest in a better environment and promoting renewable energy and a diversity of energy resources and supply. Frankly, it's a good economic development opportunity for them. The county itself stands to make a fairly significant windfall in property tax revenue over the lifespan of these wind projects. I don't want to give away any confidential figures since I can't remember and Mike's not here. I believe Sherman County was perhaps looking to the $250,000 a year boost in their property tax revenues from just one significant project. Additionally, it's a significant economic development aid for the farmers and ranchers in these areas. In windy spots, particularly very windy, attractive spots, a number of wind developers would compete to see if they could develop a project there. They'll be talking regularly to the farmers and ranchers in the area for a lease to plant the wind turbine on their property. It's not a significant interruption in their ongoing agricultural operations. It's about a quarter of an acre footprint for each turbine. But with this healthy competition going on, many of the landowners stand to do pretty well. Lease payments range anywhere from $2,500 to $5,000 per turbine per year. And it doesn't interrupt with or interfere with the ongoing operations of the ranchers and farmers out there because it's fairly small footprint. So it seems to be a win for everybody. This amendment, the 3350-2 amendments, would simply clarify in statute what everybody had hoped last session that this program would be creating. And as I understand it from looking this morning at the amendment, if a county wished to create a red zone, they would, I would assume, sit down beforehand with a particular developer. The county board would meet, adopt a resolution saying, yes, we wish to create one of these zones, submit an application to the department for approval, and in that application they would state specifically how much authorization they're looking for, no more, no less. And so if a small project came in, they could apply for, say, $20 million worth of authority. If it was all the way up to the maximum, they could apply for $100 million worth of authority. And this is just a way to ensure that they've got, again, no dangling, floating hole of authority that somebody else could swoop in and take advantage of without their ability to negotiate with them. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll finally stop talking and willingly submit to any questions or views.
Okay, any questions? Okay, Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Higby, I have two questions, forgive my lack of familiarity with this, but you've been talking about property tax exemptions. The statutes referenced, and I'm referring now, Jim, I'll just note I'm referring to the handout that you gave to us for the section, is related to income tax exemptions. So I just want to clarify how those property tax and those income tax exemptions, whether they're both applying to this type of project, whether it is just property taxes that affect just counties. My second point of confusion is the good representative who sponsored the bill was talking about Small Community Investment Program, which he called SCIP, which is much broader than just energy projects. You're talking about RED projects, say renewable rural energy development zones. Can you clarify the difference between SCIP and RED and what this bill really does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I might want to punt on describing the difference between RED and SCIP, and in a second I'll pass it along to Doris once again, but I just wanted to say that it is my understanding that these amendments are specifically directed to the RED zone program and statute and perhaps are looking to the version of House Bill 3350 as originally introduced as a convenient vehicle for attaching these improvements to those statutes. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that it would apply only to the property taxes. It's a property tax abatement program, again, just like an enterprise zone. And so in that sense, it's, as I understand it, unrelated to the underlying bill. And perhaps Doris has got the right answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, on the question of that one-page handout that talked about both the property tax and income tax abatement issues. That related to the original program that Representative Butler was speaking to, where in Sherman County they were trying to market that program and just couldn't get there because of the issues that Representative Butler spoke to, where they were required to pay such a high income to the employee in order to take advantage of the abatement program. So from the standpoint of the counties, we are supportive of the amendment of Representative Butler in that particular sort of rural program to make it more effective and possibly even used in those rural counties. The Rural Renewable Energy Program is another one of those vehicles to be used in rural areas, and the relating clause on this bill worked very nicely according to the Legislative Council, and they felt it would be better to do it in this bill. So that's why we are raising that issue here today.
All right. Any other questions?
If I can just follow up.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. So when the original bill is very brief, and all the new language seems to be in the area that's been eliminated, so are you saying that this still does what the original bill intended, and you're piggybacking the red zone piece on top of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's correct. We are dealing with the original bill, and Representative Butler had an amendment to make that program work even better, he felt, as well as the Dash 2 amendment, which deals with the rural renewable energy program that is used in rural areas. That's correct. I hope I'm clear now.
I see. We have two amendments.
You have two amendments.
Amendment
that are totally
and
your,
red.
That's
yeah.
correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. And just to further clarify, you can see that the Dash 1 amendment amends just Section 3. It replaces Section 3. And the Dash 2 amendment adds a Section 4 on to the bill without changing any of the first three sections.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Representative Dellum.
Norris, one of the things I'm interested in is in Sherman County. When you put up a wind generator, how many jobs does that bring to the community per generator FTE? Could you tell me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dellum, I frankly can't answer that right at the moment. I don't think that the benefit of this program is necessarily in jobs other than the original, putting in the business in the county. I think it's more in the investment of money into the county that makes the difference. But I think
Mr. Chair,
can answer that question.
Dallum, it does result in an increase in jobs. It's perhaps not as significant as a huge manufacturing facility located in Moreland, right in the middle of Sherman County, but to the extent that our construction jobs, initial jobs in transporting the materials and erecting the turbines on the project, their ongoing maintenance and operation jobs, there are jobs, new jobs, that are created as a result of these projects.
I'm going to a specific direction. Maintenance and operation, how many jobs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, I can only estimate, and it really depends on the size of the project, the way it's constituted, probably anywhere between 10 and 20 full-time, various shift employees.
I'm going to ask you,
just an estimate at this point.
And perhaps I should get Marty Brantley here, but 10 and 20 in Sherman County is a significant portion of the labor force, is where I'm going. And these wind generators are an economic spark to Sherman County that provide us taxes for support of everything. That if we can't attract them, we don't get that tax base at all, and we don't get that labor force at all. I'd also say that Sherman County, I believe, is number 6 in the state in unemployment, and 10 or 20 jobs is not significant in a lot of places, but in Sherman County, 10 or 20 jobs is very significant.
Any other questions? If not... And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other person like to testify on House Bill 3350? Okay, hearing none, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3350. Since there is no further business, this committee. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.